Good evening. As Jordan said, my name is Reagan Malloy, and tonight I want to talk with y'all for several minutes about Ruth chapter 1. Ruth chapter 1. If you would go ahead and turn there, please. We're going to read the first five verses to begin. First verses of Ruth chapter 1. And it reads, "In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband." So, as you can see in the screen behind me, the title of my lesson tonight is The Afflicted Find Despair. It's kind of a bummer title to open the weekend with. But really, this first chapter in Ruth, there's not much hope at all. There's not much optimism. There's not a whole lot to make you think that things are going to turn out well for the characters in this chapter. Spoiler alert: they do end up turning out well later on. But that's not the purpose of what we're going to talk about tonight. Because really, the despair and the sense of hopelessness that permeates this chapter is very important to the actions and the attitudes that we see the characters in the story have as the book progresses. So, we just read the introduction to this chapter, the first five verses, and the first verse specifically, it gives the setting for the book. And there is a ton of information to be gleaned just from this first verse. So I want to take several minutes to look in depth at what the first verse in Ruth chapter 1 is telling us. So let's look at the first phrase. The first phrase in Ruth chapter 1 and verse 1. It says, "In the days when the judges ruled." Now that is a very important point. This is during the time of the judges of Israel. Now we don't have a firm date for when during the time period of the judges Ruth takes place. However, based on several different sources that I found, it seems as though it's the latter part of the days of the judges. And this makes sense with the fact that Ruth is going to be King David's great-grandmother. So it can't be that far removed from the time of the kings. So think about the days of the judges. What was the general spiritual attitude? And that's not a rhetorical question. What was the general spiritual climate during Israel during the days of the judges? Right. Men did what was right in their own eyes. That's the final verse in the book of Judges. It says that there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So this is a really rotten time in Israel. Think about the cycle that goes on during the book of Judges, or during the time of the judges. You know, Israel would sin, God would punish them, generally with some foreign nation, sometimes with famine. We'll talk about that here in just a minute. So they'd sin, they'd be punished, but then they would repent. They would recognize their wrongdoing, and they would cry to God for deliverance, and he would send a judge to deliver them. And then generally there would be a period of peace while that judge lived, but then after the judge died, they would revert back to their old ways, and the cycle would start all over again. So things are really bad during Israel during this time. In the last five chapters of the book of Judges, it discusses just some absolutely disgusting, wicked things that God's people are involved in. These are things that would probably make some of the pagan nations recoil in disgust, and God's people are involved in them. There's idolatry, there's sexual immorality, there's homosexuality, there's rape, murder, dismemberment, there's genocide. All of this is going on in Israel. All of this is going on within God's nation. And this is how the book of Ruth opens: "In the days when the judges ruled." So that is the spiritual climate for the book of Ruth. So now let's look at the next phrase in Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. It says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. This, too, is a very important point to note. Not just because of what it causes Naomi's family to do later on, but it also gives us some more information about this, about what's going on with Israel on a spiritual level. Turn with me, if you will, to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. I'm going to begin reading in verse 20. Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 20. It reads, "The Lord will send on you curses, confusion, and frustration in all that you undertake to do, until you are destroyed and perish quickly on account of the evil of your deeds, because you have forsaken me. The Lord will make the pestilence stick to you until he has consumed you off the land that you are entering to take possession of it. The Lord will strike you with wasting disease, with fever, inflammation, and fiery heat, and with drought, and with blight, and with mildew. They shall pursue you until you perish, and the heavens over your head shall be bronze, and the earth under you. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder. From heaven, dust shall come down on you until you are destroyed." So here in Deuteronomy chapter 28, what's going on is God has, earlier in the chapter, God has given the nation of Israel the blessings that they'll receive if they but obey him. But now, the section that we were just reading, obviously not blessings, this is the curses that God is pronouncing if Israel disobeys. And I also want to note that this is part of him establishing his covenant with the nation of Israel. And that's going to be very important in this story as well, the fact that God desires a covenant relationship with his people. I think a lot of times, at least for me, when I think of a covenant, in my head, the word that immediately pops to mind to go with is contract. You have a covenant and you have a contract. They're basically one and the same, right? Not quite. A contract... contract is something that there are two parties and they both enter into this agreement. There are terms, there are penalties if the terms aren't met by each party. And that's about it. Think of it like a cell phone contract. If I go into Verizon and I say I want to cancel my contract, they're not going to like freak out and start crying and just beg me to stay. They're going to say, okay, well, this is your fee for canceling early. Have a nice day. But a covenant is a lot deeper than that. With a covenant, there is a deep emotional attachment with both parties. There is a desire for that relationship to succeed no matter what. And that is what God entered into with the nation of Israel. That's what he's entered in with us today. But that is what he's discussing here in Deuteronomy chapter 28. He's discussing his covenant relationship with the people of Israel. And what will happen based on whether or not Israel upholds their end of the covenant or not. So we see here that God has told his people that these things will happen before they even enter the promised land. And to tie this back in with our story with Ruth, again there in verse 23 it says, "The heavens over your head shall be bronze, and the earth under you shall be iron. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder. From heaven, dust shall come down on you until you are destroyed." So Ruth chapter 1, verse 1, we're told there's a famine in the land. So I believe there's a direct implication there that Israel has forsaken God. They've forsaken his covenant. And as we just read in Deuteronomy chapter 28, these are some of the results of Israel forsaking God and his covenant. They rejected the blessings and the hope that came with obedience that were mentioned earlier on in Deuteronomy chapter 20. They rejected that hope, and instead all they're left with are the curses and the despair that comes with their disobedience. So, a famine during the time of the judges. That is quite the indictment on the people of God. And now moving on, still in verse 1, we get a little more personal. Says, "And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons." So now we have a specific Israelite leaving Bethlehem for Moab. And we're told in verse 2 that the name of this Israelite is Elimelech. Now, names are very important in the book of Ruth and the meanings that are associated with them. Elimelech means my God is king. And also Bethlehem. Does anybody know what Bethlehem means? What was that? Yes, it's the house of bread. So that there's a bit of irony there, that there is a famine in the house of bread. And this man named Elimelech, my God is king, his very name is proclaiming God's sovereignty and God's power. But here we have him leaving Bethlehem, we have him leaving Israel, leaving God's promised land, because there's a famine. But not only does he leave the promised land, he leaves it for Moab. And that is also a glaring indictment on Elimelech specifically and the direction that he's taking his family. So what do we know about Moab? What Moab's history with relation to Israel, what do we know about it? Yes, firstborn son of Lot after his daughters had incest with him. So from the beginning, Moab comes from sinful beginnings. What else do we know about Moab with relation to Israel? In the book of Numbers, Balak is the king of Moab. And as Israel is on their way to the promised land, Balak is scared. He's heard about this nation of Israel. He's heard about their God and what they've been doing. And so he enlists the prophet Balaam to try and get him to curse Israel so that perhaps they might not hurt his nation, Moab. So Moab and Israel, all that to say, Moab and Israel have a very checkered past, they just don't get along. They haven't gotten along from the beginning, even though they're technically cousins, again, through Lot and Abraham. Moab and Israel just do not get along. So we have this Israelite leaving Bethlehem for Moab, for one of Israel's arch enemies, really. Can y'all think of any other times when God's people left the promised land? The ones I'm thinking of are actually before the time of Ruth. Yes. Yeah, Jacob's family went down to Egypt. And before that, there are actually two other times involving Jacob's father and his grandfather. So in Genesis chapter 12, Abraham leaves the promised land, and he goes to Egypt. And he actually leaves because of a famine. Once he gets down to Egypt, he ends up lying about his relationship to Sarah. A lot of bad things happen down there in Egypt. And then Isaac does a similar thing. In Genesis chapter 26, Isaac goes and he settles in Gerar of the Philistines. And again, there some lies are told and not end well. But then, as you mentioned, Jacob leaves the promised land. But there's something different about when Jacob leaves. Because he's finally understood it. He's learned the lesson from his father and from his grandfather that you don't leave the promised land for anything, because bad things happen when you leave the promised land. So he's learned that lesson, but actually, he needs to leave the promised land. Jacob does. So God has to come to him in a vision and actually tell him directly, listen, it's okay. Go down to Egypt. Go down to Joseph. Go to Egypt. Leave the promised land. This is part of my plan. But as a general rule, you don't leave the promised land. God's people are not supposed to leave his promised land of rest. It's interesting to note that with both Abram and Isaac, when they left, the stories of them leaving are recorded directly after God gives the promises to both of them. So in Genesis chapter 12, God makes the promise to Abraham of the land, seed, and the nation. And then right after that, Abraham gets scared because there's a famine. He trusts in himself, and he goes to Egypt, and bad things happen. Same thing with Isaac. And earlier in Genesis chapter 26, God gives the promises to Isaac as well. And then Isaac, he trusts in himself and worldly wisdom, and things go badly for him. So we see all the way back in Genesis, the first book of the Bible, there's a connection between trusting in yourself over God and misfortune befalling you. So now to recap what's going on in the book of Ruth. This is the time of the judges. It's a really bad time for God's people. There's a famine in the land, which is further, just another indication of God punishing his people for their disobedience. And you have Elimelech leading his family to Moab, which, as we just discussed, it's not good. You don't leave the promised land. But once they get to Moab, I think it's safe to assume that things go pretty well for them. Things go pretty well for them once they get to Moab. I mean, they stay there for 10 years, so obviously there's food there. That's what they're looking for to begin with. That's why they left the promised land. There was a famine. There, Elimelech and Naomi's sons find wives there. So they settle down. It actually says in verse 2, it says they went into the country of Moab and they remained there. They weren't just sojourning. They remained there. So they put down roots. They got comfortable there. But then what happens? Well, in verse 3, we're told that Elimelech dies. But then not only does Elimelech die, but also his and Naomi's two sons die. And despite the fact that they had both taken wives in Moab, that they had lived there for 10 years, we don't know if they were married the entire 10 years or for what portion of that 10 years they were married. But for whatever portion they were married, they had not had children, which is also, that's also indicative of Israel's disobedience. Another one of the curses in Genesis, in Deuteronomy 28, was a curse of barrenness as well. So they got to Moab, things were going well, but then things completely fall apart. And Naomi is left completely destitute. She has no husband, she has no children, she has no grandchildren. And really, back then, this was a death sentence for her almost. And I want to take a moment to discuss just how desperate and hopeless Naomi's situation is from her viewpoint. Because, again, the hopelessness, this despair, is going to play a large role in the attitudes and the actions that we see later on in the story. So Naomi's situation, she's in a foreign land. She's away from her people, away from God's people. Her husband dies along with her sons. There are no men left in her life. And in today's world, if we heard of that happening to somebody, that would be truly terrible. But think about it in terms of biblical times. Like I said, this is a death sentence for her almost. Because women in biblical times didn't really have roles outside of the home. There weren't jobs available to women, especially in an agricultural society like the one that Naomi would have been living in. She wouldn't be able to go into town, maybe, and apply for a job at any number of stores or restaurants that might have a now hiring sign out front. She had nothing. She had no family, no job. She was living in Moab, so she had no social structure to help take care of her. She had been back in Israel where they were supposed to have been, then she would have had that. But she doesn't because she's in Moab. So there is no hope at all for her. That is the big point, I believe, to get from these first six verses. Naomi had absolutely no hope whatsoever in Moab. Like to think of it like, I was trying to think of some modern day examples of a similar situation, and it was hard for me to think of some. There's a family that I know back home in Tennessee that they actually live somewhat farther north from where we live, but just a couple weeks ago they lost everything in a house fire. House completely burned to the ground. They lost pets. They lost all of their possessions. And I was thinking about that maybe in relationship to this situation with Naomi. But that's not even quite equivalent because, I mean, first off, they still had their family. No members of the family died. And also, I mean, today we have things like insurance and stuff like that. And just in general, there are so many things that would help people in destitute, hopeless situations. We have Medicare, Medicaid, government welfare programs. There's always some place that's looking to hire new workers. So it's really come up with an example in modern day times to help us really grasp the hopelessness of Naomi and what she's going through. I did think of one kind of hypothetical example. So imagine that there's a family in Houston this past year after the floods. They lost everything in the floods. And they decide that they're going to leave Houston. They're not going to rebuild. They're not going to wait for the help that's coming. They're going to leave. So they take whatever they have left. It may just be the shirts on their backs. And they cross the border into Mexico. They cross into Mexico. They don't speak the language. They don't know anybody there. The culture is completely different. But they acclimate. But then the husband and the sons die, just like here in the book of Ruth, leaving the wife and her two daughters-in-laws with nothing. They're in Mexico. They still don't speak the language. There is no hope for them. Again, I'm just trying to tie it in to modern days, so we might be able to grasp somewhat the despair and the hopelessness that Naomi is suffering. Now, let's continue on in the book of Ruth. Let's now look in verse 6. Ruth chapter 1 and verse 6, we find that Naomi and her two daughters-in-laws, Naomi decides to leave Moab and return to Israel. Return is a major word in this chapter. It's really a key word because it's used over and over again. And its constant use kind of insinuates that these people were somewhere where they weren't supposed to be because they needed to return. They needed to return somewhere. They were somewhere where they should not have been. They were in a situation that they should not have been in. So Naomi decides to return. And why does Naomi decide to return? What does it tell us in this passage about why Naomi decides to return to Judah? There was food. Right. Exactly. In verse 6, she heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So it sounds as if the famine is finally over in Israel. God is keeping his promises. He's fulfilling his covenant and providing for Israel like he said he would. But there's one important thing to note about this. The food is in Israel. The deliverance is in Israel. It's not in Moab where Naomi is. They're still completely hopeless there in Moab. That's why they choose to leave Moab and go to Israel, because that's where the food is. That is where God is fulfilling his promises and fulfilling his covenant loyalty. And I believe that there's a lesson to be learned here about the punishments of God. And it's that he doesn't punish his children just to afflict them. He wasn't causing a famine in the land of Israel because he wanted to, because he found enjoyment in that. No, he was punishing them so that they might return to him. And as we talked about in the book of Judges, that worked. He would punish them. They would cry out for deliverance and repent. And when they return, he cares for them like the loving father that he is. So Naomi hears that God has provided for his people. She hears that he is fulfilling his covenantal responsibility to Israel. That he had visited Israel and Judah in their distress, and he had brought them hope. So Naomi decides to set out to return to Israel, and her daughters-in-law are going with her. But Naomi tells them to stay. And she really makes a good argument for why they should stay in Moab. I'd like to read now verses 7 through 13. Ruth chapter 1, beginning in verse 7. So she being Naomi, so she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." So here Naomi is laying it out for Ruth and Orpah. She's like, "Listen, I don't have any sons for you. I don't have any sons to give you in marriage so that y'all can live a prosperous life. And even if I have sons, even if I were to find a husband in my old age, conceive tonight, and bear sons, would y'all wait 17, 20 years in order to marry them? No, she's saying it is much better for your sake if you just go back to Moab and find a husband there and live your life. Just, she's saying, just leave me here. Just leave me be. Y'all go live your own lives and forget about me. And really, as she's explaining this to Ruth and Orpah, we get another glimpse into the despair that she is suffering from. Notice the contrast in the way that she's talking. When she's talking to her daughters-in-law, when she's telling them to go back, she says at the end of verse 8, "May the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me." She's asking God's blessings on Ruth and Orpah. Yet when discussing her own conditions, she describes it as the hand of the Lord having gone out against her. She mentions that at the end of verse 13. "For it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." So on one hand, she's asking God's blessings on Ruth and Orpah. And on the other hand, she's acknowledging that his hand has gone out against her. So she's basically saying, may the Lord do for y'all the exact opposite of what he's done to me. May y'all find yourselves in just the complete opposite situation that I'm in right now. And so she ends, as we've just mentioned, by talking about how the hand of the Lord has gone out against her. And this is her perspective on everything that's happened. This is the lens through which she's viewing this whole ordeal. And she seems to recognize that the decisions that have been made in the past have caused her to be in this situation, have caused this hopelessness that she has. Most likely it was not her fault that they were in Moab. As the head of the family, Elimelech would have made that decision. He would have said, okay, we're going to Moab. We're going to try to find food there. So it's most likely not Naomi's fault that they are there in Moab. But the fact of the matter is that they are there in Moab. And Naomi is now reaping the consequences of the bad decision that Elimelech had made to trust worldly wisdom over God's wisdom. And it seems to Naomi, whether right or wrong, that God is working against her because of these bad choices. So Naomi lays the situation out before her two daughters-in-law, and Orpah decides to return to Moab. Right at the beginning, she's like, "No, I am going to go with you. I'll go with you." But then Naomi presses a little bit more, and Orpah hugs her and kisses her and returns to Moab. But Ruth really has an incredible response. Read with me now, please, beginning in verse 15. Ruth chapter 1 and verse 15. And she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So Ruth is showing a steadfast, covenantal love and loyalty to Naomi. It says, says at the end of verse 14, I didn't read that, that Ruth clung to her. Ruth clung to Naomi. And that verb clung, that is a very descriptive, intense verb, showing just how determined that Ruth was to stay with Naomi, despite the situation that they would find themselves in. And she acknowledges that it may be hard. She says, "Where you die, I will die." She says, "You know, this could very well end up in death for both of us." But despite that, despite everything, Ruth says, I'm going to stick with you, Naomi. And Naomi recognizes it, and it says she said no more. And it's interesting that this is coming from Ruth. This is coming from not a child of God. This is coming from a Moabite. This is coming from a person from the country that Israel hated, that they had been enemies for years now. But a Moabite is showing this kind of covenantal love and loyalty. Really, she's showing the kind of covenantal loyalty that Israel was supposed to have been showing to God all along. And though Elimelech had not shown that loyalty when he decided to leave Israel for Moab, Ruth is now demonstrating it to Naomi. Elimelech did a bad job leading his family. He did not show his family, he did not demonstrate to his family the kind of loyalty that he should have. But Ruth does that now for Naomi. Ruth shows her the kind of loyalty that they were to have, that we are to have now. So early on in the story, we have this pagan demonstrating really godlier attributes than God's own people. The love and this kind of love and devotion is what God desired then, and it's what he desires still now from his people. And I don't want to come down too hard on Naomi, because I think there are definite indications that she did some good things, that she had some good attributes about her. Take Ruth's response, for example. She says that Naomi's God would be her God. Now, what would make Ruth want to adopt Naomi's God as her God, especially after all that Naomi had been through? Naomi she spent a decent part of this chapter just saying how her suffering, her hopelessness has come from the hand of the Lord. But now Ruth vows to serve that same God. Why would she do that? I think that it's because through all of this, Naomi still came out at the end with the right perspective. Though it seemed as though God's hand had been against Naomi, and I think there are definite indications that it was, in fact, against Elimelech's family at some points. Though all of that, Naomi still realized that the only place she belonged was with God. That in the end, the only place that she needed to be was with God. So through this incredible amount of suffering and despair, through all of this, she turns to God. And that didn't immediately solve all of her problems. Her husband and her sons don't miraculously rise from the dead because they decided that they were going to return to Israel. She still had to deal with the consequences of the bad decisions that had been made earlier in the book. But she realizes that there is no deliverance in Moab. There is no hope in Moab for her. So she sets out to return to the promised land. She returns to God's people. She returns to where they should have been all along. And that is a very important point from this chapter, that Naomi and Ruth were not delivered in Moab. There was no deliverance in Moab. They weren't delivered while they were apart from God, while they were apart from his people. They had to return to where they should have been all along. And the same is true for us today. If we're anywhere with God, if we are putting our trust in anything but God, if we're focused on our school, on our careers, on our family, on our loved ones, if we're putting our trust and hope in any of that instead of in God, then really we have no hope. Hope and deliverance and rest can only be found in God. Now let's look at the story once they finally make it back to Israel. I like to read beginning in verse 19, now through the end of the chapter. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi, when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. So they returned to Israel. They returned to the promised land. And let's look at the response from the villagers there in Bethlehem when they come back. First thing they say, "Is this Naomi?" Just think about it. It's been about 10 years now. And besides it just being 10 years in time, Naomi's life has completely changed. So it's almost like they're saying, Is that Naomi? Like, what happened to you?" And again, like I said earlier, names are very important in this book. Naomi means pleasantness or beautiful. So you can almost hear it when she's walking, when she's entering the village, and they go, "Is this Naomi? Is this the pleasant one? Is this the beautiful one?" And then Naomi says, "Do not call me Naomi." She's like, "Don't call me the pleasant one. Don't call me the beautiful one. Call me Mara. Mara meaning bitter. Call me bitter, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." So from her response, we find that she's still in the depths of this despair. She is still basically hopeless. But she's recognizing God's hand in it. She's telling just how awful things were in Moab, how terrible her situation was without God. She says she went away full, and she has now come back empty. She lost everything when she was away from God and his people. She had no hope there, but she hasn't given up on God. That is important to know, that she has not given up on God. Though she recognizes his hand in all of this, she has not turned her back on him. And even though her situation was desperate and hopeless and tragic in Moab, she returns to Israel because she realizes that that is where hope can be found. Even though there were terrible decisions made in the past, she is still able to return to God. Because it doesn't matter how hopeless the situation seems to be, we can always return to God. Because as we talked about with the covenant relationship that we're in with him, he desires that. He desires a covenant relationship with us more than he wants to punish us. Because he doesn't want to punish us, because he loves us. And the same was true for Israel in the Old Testament. He wanted that covenant relationship with them. So when Naomi comes back, when Naomi comes back to the Promised Land, she has a hope in God, even if she's still not quite realizing it. So I think one of the main ideas in this whole story is that in the face of overwhelming tragedy and despair, one must turn to God. You have to keep your hope and your faith in him, that he will watch over you and help you according to his covenant. And even in the face of disobedience and rebellion and forsaking God, as Elimelech had led his family to do in the beginning, even in the face of that, God is still waiting. He's there. He's ready to save his people if they would but return to him. And this is shown on a larger scale with the nation of Israel. The book opened in the days of the judges, wicked, dark, and evil times in Israel's history. Every man was doing what was right in his own eyes. There was a famine indicative of God's judgment. But here at the end of the chapter, God has visited his people. God has visited his people and given them food. It says in verse 22 that they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So he visits them and provides for them because he is a loving father. Think about the time of the judges. What has Israel done to deserve that kind of grace and that mercy? Nothing, especially here in the latter part of the judges when wickedness was just running rampant. They didn't deserve this, but God was loving and he provided for them because he desires that covenant. He was more interested in having the relationship. He was more interested in having the relationship that the covenant had established than he was in punishing Israel according to the terms of the covenant. And the same is true for us today. He desires the covenant relationship with us. And he will never break his covenant. And because he is gracious and because he is merciful, he will accept us back if we will but return to him. So we saw it with Naomi. We saw it on a larger scale with Israel. And now back to Naomi again. Though it's not going to be fully realized until later on in the book, God is preparing amazing things for Naomi's life. Though in the end of chapter 1, she's feeling destitute. She's feeling hopeless. She's asking to be called bitter. However, there are a few indications of God's blessing. Like we've talked about, he has visited his people, and they returned to Bethlehem, the house of bread, at the time of the barley harvest. And there's also the fact that she's not completely alone. She has Ruth with her. And Ruth, through her covenant love and her covenant loyalty, she's going to be an incredible blessing to Naomi. I think we have to be careful that when we're going through trials, when we're going through really desperate times, that we don't become self-absorbed. We have to be able to see past our own despair, and we have to be able to see God. Because I think Naomi tends to get a little bit self-absorbed in this passage. She says, I left whole, and God has brought me back empty. Well, she wasn't completely empty. Like we just said, she had Ruth with her. She had that amazing love of her that her daughter-in-law was showing her. She has her friends in the village. They come running to meet her. So she was not completely empty, even though she may have felt that way. But she was still partially blinded by her pain, and she couldn't see what God was potentially doing for her. So in just a moment, I'd like to spend a few minutes discussing our reactions to trials. But before I get to that, I want to mention what seems to be one of the main ideas to get from chapter 1. And that is, we see that Elimelech and his family, they left Israel for Moab when things got tough. And it seems that for a time, they had what they needed in Moab. Like we talked about, they lived there for 10 years. They found wives for their sons. They put down roots there. But then everything came crashing down around them. The peace and prosperity that Moab had to offer was fleeting. And Naomi finally recognizes that she needs to return to Israel, where she should have been all along. So the lesson to learn from all of this is that it's far better to lose everything, yet still be in that relationship with God, still have that fellowship with God. It's far better to do that than it is to have everything that we could physically want or need and to leave God, to leave his presence. And Naomi learned this lesson the hard way. But it's vital for us to understand that it's far better to be with God and have nothing than to have everything and be without God. So how do we react when we're faced with difficult times, like Naomi was? Do we turn our backs on God? Do we forsake him? Do we try to figure things out for ourselves? If we do any of those type things, then really that's the worst decision that we can make. That's what Elimelech seems to have done when he left the Promised Land. And it turned out absolutely horribly for his family. Because the fact of the matter is that we're going to go through difficult times here on this earth. Some of you in this audience may already have. Maybe you've been thinking about times in your own lives that are similar to this, as we've been discussing this story of Ruth. But the difficult times that come in our lives, they come for various reasons and from various places. And there are different reactions that we can have when these hard times come. I think one reaction that many people in the world, and some Christians can have as well, is that when they witness or encounter suffering, they blame it on God. Whether they say that, you know, this is coming directly from him, which I believe that's a blatantly wrong belief to hold, or that God should have prevented the suffering. So there are several things, there are several issues with both of these ways of thinking. I want to start with the first idea, that suffering comes directly from God. There is exactly one circumstance in the Bible in which it could be said that God causes suffering. And we'll get to that one example here in just a minute. But generally, when it's said that God afflicts someone, I think that's being said like the affliction is arbitrary, like God is afflicting for no apparent reason at all, that he just kind of picks at random. But that goes against his very nature. He is the creator. He created us. He created us in his own image. And we're told that he's not willing for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. So the Bible shows us time and time again that God loves his creation, that he wants what is best for us. So it's not possible to harmonize this loving, caring, committed God with a God who afflicts and causes suffering for no apparent reason. Now, I did say that there is one instance in the Bible where it could be said that God afflicts us, that he allows us to be afflicted. But the thing is, that one example, that doesn't depend solely on God. And it really actually ties into his loving and just nature. It's not a case of him picking and choosing arbitrarily who he's going to afflict. No, the one time that God afflicts man is when man chooses to sin. It's when man transgresses God's law. It's when man turns his back on God. When man chooses to not do the very thing that he was put on this earth to do. We're put on this earth to worship and glorify and praise our Creator. Yet when we don't do that, that is when it can be said that yes, God afflicts us. And really the interesting thing to note is that, you know, we're being afflicted because we're not serving him, because we're glorifying him. But through our punishment, God is still glorified. He's glorified either way. He will either be glorified by us as we praise him, as we strive to live our lives like his son, or he'll be glorified when we're punished. It will show that he is all powerful, that he is just, that he is holy. So we already talked some about in Deuteronomy chapter 28 when God put forth the blessings and the curses for obedience and disobedience, respectively. And we see those blessings and those curses being fulfilled all throughout Israel's history. But then in the New Testament, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 6, it references God afflicting those who afflict the saints, who afflict his children. And then in Hebrews chapter 12, we're told that God chastises the one he loves as a father disciplines his child. So, again, this one instance where it could be said that God afflicts, it's when people are working against him. But he does it because he wants them to come back to him. He wants to drive those who are working against him, those who have forsaken him. He wants to drive them back to him, again, because he loves us. And I think we see examples of this in the story of Ruth. Naomi certainly saw them. She talks about the hand of the Lord being against her. But again, God is not punishing because he enjoys it. He's punishing, he's doing it because he is good. It's because he wants us to change and come to him. I believe that this world is set up in a way that it's supposed to drive us back to God if we leave him. The brokenness, the filth, the hopelessness that just permeates this physical world, all of that should drive us back to God. It should drive us back to where we can be whole, to where we can be pure, to where we can have our hope realized in Christ. And then, as I mentioned, there's also the idea that God should prevent the suffering. Not that it necessarily comes directly from him, but that he should at least prevent it. If he is, in fact, a loving, all-powerful God, then he wouldn't let me suffer like this. He wouldn't have let this person die. He wouldn't have let this natural disaster happen. We've all heard heard things like that. And there is some truth to that idea, but just maybe not quite in the way that people intend when they say it. Because, you know, there is going to come a day when we no longer suffer. There's going to come a day when there's no more dying, there are no more disasters. But that day is not going to be on this earth. And that I believe, is where people can get tripped up. That day is going to be when we're all gathered around God's throne to worship him for eternity. Because people look for that peace. They look for that lack of suffering here on this earth, and they get upset with God when they can't find it. But the fact is, it's impossible to find that here. Complete rest will only be found in eternity with God. And I think that ties in with the most obvious reason that I can think of for why there is suffering here on this earth. For why people who are seeking God, who are in fellowship with him, sometimes suffer. And that's because we live in a broken, in a dying world. Turn with me, if you will, please, to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, going to begin reading in verse 18. Romans chapter 8, beginning in verse 18. Paul says, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now." So, as we read here, the creation is groaning. The creation is chained, it's in bondage because of Adam's sin. Because when Adam sinned, when man sinned, sin and death entered the world, and not only that portion of God's creation, but all of God's creation experiences that death and that decay. So I believe that this really ties in to why there is suffering here on this earth. just because the world that we're in is sinful and broken, and it's dying. It's longing to be released. And hand in hand with this idea of the broken world is the fact that Satan is the ruler of this world. Look at the story of Job. Job was a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. God described him as that. That is a quotation from God himself, that Job was blameless and upright, that he feared God, that he turned away from evil. Yet, look at all of the just awful things that happened to Job. And, of course, we're told that it's because of Satan. Satan went to God, and he gets permission to tempt Job, to try and cause him to turn against God. So again, the fact that Satan is walking this world, that he, as we're told, he walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour, that is yet another reason that there is affliction, that there is suffering in this world. Because though Satan is going to be defeated, and in some ways he already has been defeated, he's trying to take as many souls with him as he can. And because he is so powerful, because he is so wicked, he knows exactly how to tempt people to get them to turn from God and to give up hope. And a lot of times that may involve afflicting them and causing them to suffer here in this present world. Because he wants them, as I said, he wants them to turn from God and to give up hope. And those two things really go in hand, don't you think? That turning from God and giving up hope. I'd like to read Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 3. It says, "Not only that, but we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us." So here we find the correct response to suffering. Verse 3 says, "We are to rejoice in our sufferings, because," says, "suffering produces endurance, then character, character hope, and hope does not put us to shame. And we have that hope because God's love has been poured out into us." So there are important lessons to be learned, going back to Ruth now. There are important lessons to be learned from Ruth 1 about God's covenant relationship with his people and the hope that they can have in him. And so we have examples in this story. We have examples of God's people not hoping in him, not trusting in him, and striking out on their own. But though they may have experienced some temporary physical blessings when they did that, things eventually get drastically worse than when they were in the famine still in Israel. See, Elimelech took his family to Moab trying to save them. He was trying to save them from the famine. But the irony in it is that they end up dying anyways. His family ends up dying in Moab, the very place that he took them trying to save them. But through her despair, Naomi realizes that where she always belonged was with God and with his people. And when she decides to return, Ruth is there with her every step of the way, demonstrating the kind of covenant loyalty that Elimelech and his family should have been showing to God from the very beginning. So Ruth and Naomi, they return to Israel, still destitute, still broken, as is evidenced by Naomi's name change. She says, "Call me Mara." But they now have a hope. Even if Naomi can't quite see it yet, there's a hope because they are returning to God. And again, as we close, I want to reemphasize the lesson to be learned from chapter 1, that it's far better for us to lose everything that we have but still be with God, still be in fellowship with God, still have that covenantal relationship with God. It's far better for us to lose everything and still have that than it is to have everything that this world could offer and yet not be in fellowship with God. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention.